Psalm 1. Blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked, or stand in the way that sinners take, or sit in the company of mockers. But whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and who meditates on his law day and night. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever they do prospers. Okay. Not so the wicked. They are like chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked leads to destruction. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, good morning. In the past, we've reflected on the film Castaway. You might have seen that film with Tom Hanks. He's abandoned on a desert island, or not a desert island, a deserted island. Basically, the film is this, Hanks plays this FedEx executive, and he's totally chasing after careerism and the corporate ladder and that whole thing, and he's missing out on the deeper things, the substantial things of life. And the opening scene, he's having a Christmas Eve dinner with his girlfriend, and he gets a call from headquarters saying he's needed in Malaysia. So being kind of true to form, he just drops everything, says, hey, you need to give me a ride to the airport. She's somewhat annoyed, as you can imagine. It's Christmas Eve. She takes him to the airport. They exchange kind of paltry gifts, and the plane takes off. Somewhere over the South Pacific, they start losing cabin pressure. The plane begins to spiral, crashes into the ocean, and he wakes up on this deserted island. And, you know, initially it's this kind of battle to try and survive, right? How's he going to get water? I don't know if you've seen the film. He's trying to get water out of this coconut. There's a lot of really funny scenes related to that. He does some spear fishing to try and have food. But that's actually not the biggest challenge. It's not the physical side of things. It's the hardest thing. It's actually living with himself. So he's in this kind of forced timeout, for parenting term, or like a forced sabbatical. So he's now alone with his thoughts, he's alone with the life he's led, he's alone with a lot of regrets, and he has to figure out how in the world is he going to survive that reality. And somehow he does kind of make it through, and he actually ends up into a much better, more meaningful, flourishing life. And so at the end of the film, he's having this conversation with his friends, and he shares this reflection of life on this island. He says, I was going to die there totally alone, and I was going to get sick or injured or something, and the only choice I had, the only thing I could control was when and how and where it was going to happen. So I made a rope, and I went up to the summit to hang myself. I had to test it, you know, of course, because you know me. He was a guy who was always kind of testing things, and yet the weight of the log snapped the limb of the tree, so I couldn't even kill myself the way I wanted to. I had power over nothing. And that's when this feeling came over me like a warm blanket. I knew somehow that I had to stay alive. Somehow I had to keep breathing, even though there was no reason to hope. And then one day my logic was all proven wrong because the tide came in and it gave me a sail. It's this amazing story of recovery of a man who actually finds deeper significance, deeper meaning, deeper purpose. But the part for me that's really encouraging is where he found it. So like, a lot of us think that this good life we seek, this life that's fuller and more flourishing, it's a life that you got to find under the right conditions, right? So we say things like, oh, maybe when summer comes, or maybe when I retire, maybe when the kids go off to school, maybe when I'm finished with treatment, maybe when I'm less busy at work. We feel like the life we want is a life that we can only find when all the conditions line up and are perfect. But actually, if you get to know the kind of Tom Hanks of life in this sense, that they often find it when life is really hard and difficult. And actually, that's what this psalm is about. You might not have picked up on that, how blessed is the man. It's this word ashrei, and wisdom teachers would go off giving these little parables and these stories by saying, how blessed is the person who. The Greeks did this. They talked a lot about the good life. Or rabbis would start this list of what a flourishing, fruitful life looks like. And they began with this Hebrew word, ashrei, which is how blessed is the one, or how good is a life for the one. And what's amazing about this is the conditions in which this psalm is written. So you may not be aware that the Psalms were a bunch of psalms for like hundreds of years, Moses, David, a bunch of other people, but they came together under Israel's exile. In other words, all the little psalms were put into this collection called a Psalter when life was incredibly hard. That it was under those conditions that Israel learned how to pray. They learned what praise actually is. The beautiful psalms were written under these really hard conditions when they'd been uprooted from Jerusalem and forced to live in slavery, and they're living in this arid, dry climate where there is no water. And yet this psalm says, what, look on the horizon, here's a tree. Here's this beautiful flourishing tree. And it's not just a planted tree by water. The word there is better translated a transplanted tree. In other words, a tree that was in its native soil but was pulled out of its native soil and put alongside not just a stream of water but a canal. There's a lot of canals in Babylon. And so Israel was forced to live on the riverbanks of Babylon. And so here's this tree that's like a little mini Israel. And in the harshest of climates and conditions, when it was, you know, cast away onto the deserted island of Babylon, so to speak, when life was horrible, it's blessed is the one. It's finding this flourishing. It's finding life. It's finding vitality. And its fruit is for the world. And so the invitation is to say, if you're looking for a good life, if you want a life that, like, there's depth, that something matters, like you feel full in life, like, here's an image. Here's an image of a fruitful tree, and you could plant yourself here, and you could you could sink your roots down deep into this source of life. And so I want to look at this kind of good life that's a progression, the progression of a good life. The life we desire is a life that's going to grow. It's going to develop over time. And it's really ultimately a matter of what you meditate on. That's your roots, where they go into, like what your source is. That's going to lead to the good life or to the empty life, we'll see. And ultimately, it sets a destiny. It sets a course. It sets a finality to it. So the good life is a progressive life of endless meditation that leads to an ultimate destiny. And so I want to look at, first of all, just the progression of this good life. If you now turn to the psalm with me, blessed is the one in verse 1, or how good is the life for the one who does not walk in step with the wicked, or stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the seat of scoffers, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and who meditates on his law day and night. You notice as we kind of read that through, can you feel the progression in it? There's a lot of trios. In other words, there's things of three. And so one of the progressions is it goes from someone who's walking and then to someone who's standing to someone who's sitting. So that's a progression, right? There's a movement, and the movement is gradually getting slower and slower and slower, and then it's stuck in a place. So this is someone who's, there's a movement from progression to slowly settling in, and you could say planting yourself somewhere. And there's also this movement from a wicked to a sinner to a scoffer. That's another trio. There's a movement from who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. The counsel is the mind, like what you focus on, and it does not stand in the way of sinners. That's a form of behavior and living and acting, or sit in the seat of scoffers. That's a place of like dwelling and belonging. And so there's a progression there as well. So what it's kind of saying is the good life is something that you kind of gradually work yourself into, you grow yourself into. It begins with advice, the advice you take, the company whose aims and directions in life you seek to follow. Like, where are you going, and who's setting your goals, and who's establishing your values, and where is your heart aiming? Be really careful to think about where you're getting counsel for life. So like, counsel is something that guides and directs someone. They say, these are the things that matter. These are the things that are important. So the good life depends at the first step on your heart and your mind aiming towards some source of counsel and wisdom and direction. That's one thing to be thinking about. And already there, therefore, we know that the good life is influenced by community. I mean, you could say, like they say in AA, like, show me your friends and I'll show you your future. So it's this idea of a community that has values and ideas and thoughts, and it's going to aim you in a certain direction. And then it goes on to talk about this way, the standing in the way of sinners. What is the way in the Bible? The Bible talks a lot about this way language. It's a path. It's a well-trod ground. And so it's an accumulation of those aims and desires that get codified into choices, and then those choices get codified into habits, and then those habits get codified into a character and a whole way of being. And so it's saying you really want to avoid the counsel of the wicked, because they'll lead you to start standing and imbibing and putting into your own life the way of sinners. So what are sinners? Sinners are people who are missing the aim. To sin is to fire at the wrong target. So there's a point to life. There's a thing we should all be aiming for, but a sinner is so controlled by impulses and misguided direction that they're aiming for the wrong thing. So their life has a lot of cul-de-sacs, like they go around and around, or they end up somewhere empty, or they end up misfiring a lot. And so it creates this life of just impulses that are going in different directions and chasing after different things, but not making any kind of progress. And then it says that you go from that way of sinners, that lifestyle, from the mind to behaviors, and then ultimately to a sense of belonging. That's the seat of the scoffers. A seat is somewhere you sit, obviously, but it's talking about like a club, an assembly, a group, a place where you are actually there and you belong there. And you're now finding yourself in the seat of mockers or scoffers. Now, what's a scoffer? Well, a scoffer, you know, to scoff at something is to kind of look down on the thing. Like, scoffers are jaded often. They've been hurt by life. They've made bad decisions in life. And so they harden. They get resentful. They get bitter. And they can't see the good things that are happening around them. In fact, they kind of get annoyed when good things are happening. They're always deconstructing things, but never able to build up things. They're always seeing through all the silver linings and seeing the feet of clay, but they can't ever actually say, oh, here's really something good we should be grateful for. So to scoff is this position of resentment and hardness towards life. And that's where this person is ending up, in this place that's very jaded and very, very hardened and very not open to actually the wonderful things, that actually the beauty that can happen in life. And the way this all happened was this progress. It went from your mind desiring something to your behaviors imbibing something to you finding that actually you've been defined by, or you belong in a certain kind of community that's kind of pulling you to pieces. So you go from desires to behaviors and habits to character to destiny. You know, I'll never forget this story of reading about this young man who committed a hit-and-run accident. And I read about this. It was kind of a journalist went to investigate this person, just wanted to understand, like, how does someone commit a hit-and-run? And so what this man did was, I guess it was dark and raining, and maybe he had been drinking a little bit. He hit a woman, and then he dragged her under the car for like 300 meters, and then just she fell, you know, rolled out to the side of the road, and he just drove off and left her. And obviously, the authorities try and figure this out, and they find out that it's this young man who did it, and so now he's serving a life sentence. And so this journalist wanted to figure out, well, how does someone get to that place? Like, how do you become the kind of person who does that? So she goes to prison, and she interviews him, and she's really surprised that he actually seems really kind and, like, really normal. It's not this monster of this figment of the imagination she had created. And she said, look, you know, you seem like a pretty normal person. Like, how did you ever get to the place where you left this woman? Like, how did you do it? And he said, well, I got to tell you a story. He said, when I was a young kid, my father used to collect antique watches, and I loved his watches. And so he would keep them in his bedroom in this drawer. And one day I went into the drawer to look at one of my dad's antique watches, and I was unfolding it from this little cloth that it was in, and it slipped through my fingers, and it fell to the floor, and the face cracked of the watch. And he said, rather than picking up this watch and just running to my father and saying, Dad, I know I should have been in the drawer. I know these are your favorite watches. I'm so sorry I broke it. He said, I just quickly folded up in the cloth, I put it in the drawer, and I walked away. And he said, Dad obviously later on discovered, you know, that his watches had been broken. So he's interrogating all of the siblings, saying, who was in the watches? Who was playing with it? And he said, I just shrugged my shoulders and said, I have no idea, Dad. And he said, from that point on, I learned as a young person that it was a lot easier for me to run away from my problems rather than actually facing and dealing with my problems. So whenever a test came up that I didn't really feel like preparing for, what I would do is I'd just copy off of someone's paper in order to get through it and get the grade I wanted. But then if someone caught me copying the paper, I would come up with some funny excuse or I'd blame something else so that I wouldn't actually have to get in trouble for it. And he said this, he said, all of my life, I failed these little tests of life. And then when the big test came, the hit and run, I failed that one too. And now I'm going to spend the rest of my life in prison for it. Now, that's a powerful story. But do you see the accumulation? Do you see how that goes from a desire? I don't know. What was it his desire? Was it comfort? Was it safety to avoid? And how that then leads you to make choices to cover up, to not address, to not confront, to not own. And then that becomes a habit, a way of doing certain things. Like you just avoid things and don't face them. And then that becomes a character and a flaw. And now your destiny has been set. And that's what this psalm is saying. And I can just look at your faces right now. The stakes are high. Like this is a high-stakes psalm. I get it. But this psalm is inviting you into the good life. And what it's saying is, it's a progression. It's not just going to happen immediately. It's going to take a period of time. Progression. Secondly, it's a meditation. So this life that ends up being quite empty or quite, you know, broken or, you know, sitting in the seat of the scoffers is contrasted with, but in his law he delights, and in his law he meditates day and night. Okay, so one life is contrasted to a life that delights in the law of the God, and then in his law he meditates day and night. Now, I just want you to, by the way, in this sermon, we're meditating, okay? This is what this sermon actually is. It's an extended meditation. So what is interesting about this phrase is, in his law he delights. He delights. Notice that word. It doesn't just say that in his law he complies, or he has this spiritual practice of reading the Bible a whole lot. Doesn't actually put it that way. Doesn't just say in his law is his duty or in his law is like his obligation. It uses this word delight. Now, that word delight doesn't seem to fit with that word law, does it? In his law, the law of God, he delights. Like, who delights in law? Like, you just take, I don't know, the code of from the DMV, the driving place at Massachusetts, is just, ooh, how I delight to know, you know, how many seconds I should follow behind the car in front of me, and, you know, no one delights in laws, right? And yet, here's a person delighting. It's a source of endless reflection and joy. What is this law? It's this word Torah. Torah, that's how you should probably say it. And the word Torah means, actually, not just law. Don't think of it as law. Think of it as instruction, direction, aim. See, yara, Torah, yara, is to throw, to shoot, to aim something. It's like a javelin. When you take a javelin and you yara to hit a target. And so God's Torah is aiming, guiding, and pointing you in a direction of vitality and flourishing and abundance and generosity and joy. It's a wisdom term. It's a term to lead you into flourishing. And the Torah is basically the first five books of the Bible. And those books are not just endless laws. Like if you go and read it, you're not going to just see like a tax code, okay? It's stories, mostly. It's a story of God and a people and how they fall away from him. And then he wants to rescue the whole world through one family. And then he has to rescue that family out of Egypt. And he takes them to a promised land, but they betray him for other idols. And then he promises again that he's going to rescue him from Babylon. It's a story that you sink the roots of your life into and absorb. And there are commands and there's poetry and all kinds of stuff. But it's in his law that he delights and he meditates on the law. Now, what is meditate? You know, a lot of us think of like, I don't know, like a guy sitting, you know, with his legs crossed and om or something like that. You know, that's not the idea here. Meditate gets picked up as a word describing a lion over its prey in Isaiah chapter 30. Have you ever watched like the National Geographic Channel or whatever, where the lion finally gets the gazelle and then they're in the Serengeti and the animal is laying there and the lion has one paw over the neck and he's just like, Yeah, that's this word. It's the sound made. But it's not just a sound, it's a relishing. It's, this is going to be good. It's anticipating. It's rolling it over on the tongue of his mind. It's rehearsing what it's going to be. It's looking into all the little details. It's actually the same word in Psalm 2, how people plot to overthrow the Messiah. They have schemes, they have plots, they're imagining how to take God down, how to ruin the kingdom of God, how to dethrone the Messiah. It's ruminating, it's rehearsing, it's planning. You know, our dog, we used to have a dog named Nellie, and I remember it was wintertime, it was one of those wonderful sunny days of wintertime. She was a sheepdog, she loved kind of being outdoors in the winter, and I look out and she's just sprawled on the in the snow, chewing on this bone. And I'm like, where did that come from? And I kind of go over to the bone, and it's gnarly looking. It's like cobwebs in the thing. It is disgusting. And she's having the time of her life, and apparently she dug it up in the garden, found it somehow, and was just reviewing it. And she's licking it and chewing it for a little while, then putting it down. She's got one paw on it, kind of looking at me like, don't you even think about taking this bone? And I'm not going to touch it, believe me. And she'd chew on it, and then she'd go and she'd bury it. And I think, thank goodness the bone is gone finally. It's so disgusting. And then here it comes again. She digs it out, brings it out, chews on it some more, licks it some more. Like, that's this, that's kind of disgusting now what I'm saying. But sometimes analogies break down. But it's imagining, it's tasting, it's delighting in. It's not less than study, but it's more. It's like what we're doing in this passage. It's what we're doing in this sermon. We're getting into it. We're looking at it. We're doing some word studies. We're looking how words compare. We're seeing a progression. You're doing some study, but you're delighting in. You're working it out. You're saying, what does this reveal about the character of God? What does this reveal about the human condition? What if I really believe this true of God? What if I really saw this as true of my own condition? What would change in my life if I actually put this into practice? How would my kids change if I actually could teach it to them? Oh, I have a neighbor over here who would really benefit from this concept. Like, it's really going deep and thinking through what it all means and working it all in. So it's progressive. It's meditation on the Torah, on the instruction of God. Lastly, it leads to a destiny. It leads to a destiny. The psalm ends with two images. One is the image of this fruitful, like, revitalized tree. And it says, he will be like a tree transplanted by streams of water. Okay, meditate on that image. He will be like a tree. So the good life is a life of progressive meditation that makes you into a tree. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means it's organic. The good life is going to be organic. It's going to be inside out, not outside in. Organic things grow from the roots, from the inside, from internal transformation that leads to external transformation. Mechanical things are outside in. It's like a wall, you stack it up, or a building, you make it, or a car, you manufacture it. That's not the image of the good life. This good life is one of organic, internal, gradual, progressive growth. And then it says, meditate on the fact that it says, it gives its fruit in season. It gives fruit. The good life is not just going to be a life that you enjoy, that you like. It's going to be a life for other people. A life that's fruitful. That's what fruit's for. I mean, have you ever seen a tree eating its own fruit? That would look kind of weird. I mean, most of the time, the fruit falls off or it's taken by a bird, it's enjoyed by something else, and it has seeds in it, and the seeds spread. So the good life is going to feel good the better it's for others. A good life is going to be not just something that's good for you, but good for your community. A good life will never be complete until everybody else around you is experiencing the good life. And a lot of us might say, you know, I don't feel like I need much from this song because my life is already good. Fine, wonderful. I'm so glad you can say that. How about everybody else's life around you? How about everybody else's life in your community? Like, the good life is supposed to be good for them as well. It bears fruit, but it bears fruit in season. Meditate on that word, in season. Now, what is that saying? That's saying that the good life is not going to be one life of endless, bizarre fruit popping off constantly all the time. Like, half the time, maybe you're looking at the tree and seeing, I don't see any fruit. I don't see anything happening. There's seasons to it. There'll be seasons of, wow, it's all coming together. It's all happening. And then there are going to be seasons where it's just a drought, or it's going to be really cold and frosty. And yet, it says, but its leaf does not wither. So then you meditate on that little phrase, a tree that it's growing in all seasons. There's life in all seasons. And so when you want to think through that, you start to say, well, that means that That means it's either growing outwardly in fruitful ways that we can see, or if it's a bad season, it's growing still in ways that we can't see. Maybe it's growing down instead of up and out. Maybe it's going in instead of outside. Maybe in the wintertime, those roots, because it's really cold outside and there's not enough water or a drought, maybe they have to go deeper. And so it's becoming more resilient and it's becoming wider. And we can't see anything because it's all below the surface. But give it some time, another season will come and there's going to be fruit. And so you meditate on that little phrase, who yields its fruit in season. And now you've begun to see what this good life looks like. And then it contrasts it with not so the wicked. Their lives are like chaff. Chaff. It's actually a word that sounds like what it means. Chaff. What is chaff? Well, if you're in an agricultural culture, you go out and you harvest all your grain. So like you've got these corns that are going everywhere. You can tell I'm very agricultural. My wife is rolling her eyes. She's like, you always talk about things you don't know anything about. This is an example. You got the wheat and the corn, and the harvester comes through, it gathers it all up, and in the ancient world, they would lay it on what's called a threshing floor. So you got these big piles, stalks of corn or wheat. Now, does anybody take one of those 5-foot stalks of corn to the table? That would be kind of confusing, wouldn't it? If everybody did that, like, what are you going to do with that thing? So what you have to do is you got to thresh it. And the way you thresh it is you get an ox, you put a yoke around it, and they roll this stone wheel on top of all that harvested grain. And why are they doing that? Well, because they're trying to break it down. They're trying to get the stuff of value and nutrition and worth separated from the stuff that's really only good to, like, start fires with. And so they roll these stones over the big pile of grain, or they whack it with these sticks, and they're threshing it. And then now you've got a bunch of stuff that's all kind of just broken down. So now how are you going to separate the wheat from the chaff? Well, what you do is you take your winnowing fork, and you get under this stuff, and you throw it in the air. And you know how in that psalm it says, but the wind drives the chaff away? That's what happens. You take the pile, you fling it in the air, and all the light, insubstantial, empty chaff goes, whoosh, and all the grain falls right back down to the threshing floor. And then you take that and you, I don't know, make cornbread or whatever you do with it. So this is the image, though. The image is of someone who obviously can go whoosh, as a person. They have no roots. They have no substance. They have no density, weight. There is no nutritional value, in other words. We can let that go. And it's saying that a life could become like that. A life could lack roots. A life could lack substance. A life could lack weight. A life could become something that the circumstances of life just, and there they go. And it's like, do you want that life that's blowing away in the wind? Or do you want to be this tree that's been transplanted by a stream of water that's somehow thriving in the midst of the worst possible circumstances? For the wicked will not stand in the assembly of the righteous, but the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish, the end. And that's Psalm 1. Now, if that's all you heard, like, you would get a bit of a mistake on this. Because the truth is that we all have chaff-like tendencies. We all tend to plant ourselves in the wrong places, to listen to the wrong advice, to create the wrong behaviors, and to end up in the wrong places. And were it left to us, like, we would all just blow away with the wind. And so you got to put Psalm 1 in the context of this bigger story, which does not just say how good is the life for the one who meditates on the Word of God, but later a psalm is going to say, blessed is the one whose sins have been forgiven and for whose transgressions have been covered. And here when it says in Psalm 1, standing in the assembly of the righteous, and we could get self-righteous about that, like, I'm going to stand. Then David later says in a psalm, O Lord, if you should keep a record of wrongs, O Lord, who could stand? And you begin to see in the Bible that justification and salvation and standing at the final day is ultimately not going to be an accumulation of our wise and good choices, ultimately. Were we just simply left to that? But it's going to be this thing called the gift of God and grace, who declares righteous though one is chaff somehow. And how does that happen? Well, the next psalm, Psalm 2, talks about the Messiah, the King, the Rescuer. And the final phrase of the psalm is another, blessed is the one. Except it says, blessed is the one who takes refuge in him. Blessed is the one whose ultimate refuge is not their meditation or the accumulation of their life or even their own fruitfulness, as good as those things are, but who takes refuge in the Messiah. I'll close with this. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, to me, is one of these pictures of the flourishing good life. He was a man devoted to the Word. He's a man who pastored churches. He was committed to the Nazi resistance movement. He was a prophetic voice defending the Jewish community during a time of great testing and trial. If anybody was this tree planted by a stream of water, one of the people that comes to mind for me is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And yet, he was full of doubt. He was full of conflicted feelings. He struggled. And in his final letters, there's these letters from prison. He was sentenced to death by hanging. He's got a journal. We have journals of what he wrote. And he has a poem that he wrote just before he died. And this is how he processed his conflicts before God. I want to read it for you if I can find it. Yeah, here it is. Here's him processing. And this is where, listen for where the hope is here. It's called, Who Am I? Who am I? They often tell me I would step from my cell's confinement calmly, cheerfully, firmly, like a squire from his country house. Who am I? They often tell me I would talk to my warders freely and friendly and clearly, as though it were mine to command. Am I then really all that which other men tell of? Or am I only that which I know of myself, restless and longing and sick, like a bird in a cage, struggling for breath as though hands were compressing around my throat, powerlessly trembling for friends at infinite distance, weary and empty at praying, at thinking, at making, faint and ready to say farewell to it all. Who am I? This or the other? Am I one person today and tomorrow another? Am I both at once, a hypocrite before others and before myself, a woebegone, weakling? Who am I? They mock me, these lonely questions of mine. Whoever I am, Thou knowest, O God, I am thine. O God, one day to hear our name when we enter into your presence, to hear you say our name, to be known by you, because of your love, because of your grace, to marvel at what you've made of our flailing at times attempts to somehow become a tree that we didn't even know we were becoming, to somehow have fruit that we bore that we didn't even see that we were bearing. Oh God, have mercy on us. Help us to go deep into you and your grace and the reflection of your grace and your wisdom and your instruction, that we might love you with our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our neighbor as ourselves. Amen.